Okay, so continuing the We're Separate Because series, and today looking at the topic of money. Now, I'll start by saying something, a bit of an admission, which is that I've been putting off presenting this message for about 18 months. And my reason is really, really simple. When I listen to Christian speakers talk about money, they're always people who have been very, very successful with money. So when I listen to Dave Ramsey, who's a Christian financial advisor, he's a multimillionaire. So when he says, you should do this with your money, there's a motivation to listen, isn't there? When I listen to Rabbi Lapin, who's a business consultant, again, a Christian advisor, again, a multimillionaire, and I think, but I'm not. Right, so, you know, what have I got to say? But then over that last year and a bit, I've changed my viewpoint a little bit. Because if what I present to you is from the Bible, and if what I present to you is from good, sound advice from experts, it's still right, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of standpoint we're going to come from. Now, first of all, a little bit of interaction. How many verses can we think of from the Bible on the subject of money? And I'm particularly interested in verses where we've heard sermons preached on them. Go on.
Money's the
money's the root of all evil.
No, it's the love of money.
Thank you. This quote is not so well done. It's all right, Paul. Right, I'm going to keep
counting. Can't
it.
Serve God.
God and mammon.
And mammon, okay. No man can serve two masters. Yeah. You love the one and hate the other, etc. Yeah, okay.
Tax collectors.
Okay, that's loosely about money, all right, okay, even tax collectors and sinners came to Christ, yeah, okay, that's three. Yeah.
30 pieces of silver?
No. Okay, I mean, yeah, all right, we're getting off the subject of what we would do with money, but okay, that's four.
It's the one about the, it's easier for
the camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go through the king of heaven. That's five, yeah, okay, good.
Widow's might.
Okay, widow's might, six. Mm-hmm.
Render
to Caesar what is Caesar's, yeah, and to God what is God's.
And then we've got the Old Testament one about how we spend our money and it will open up the wind.
Malachi 3:10-8, whatever it is, yeah. Bring full tithe into the storehouse.
Yes,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've taken the liberty of representing all the examples you've just given as that little white dot on the screen there. Because you're absolutely right. Basically, if you had to do a three-sentence summary of what the church has historically taught on the subject of money, it would be money is evil, give as much as possible to the church, and if you're really lucky, God will bless you. But I've also taken the liberty of representing as that much larger square the actual number of verses in the Bible on the subject of money, which adds up to around about 2,500 scriptures. Anyone spot anything wrong with that picture?
We don't talk about money.
We don't talk about money. And yet if there's that much in the Bible about money, clearly money is something God cares a lot about. So I'm going to talk from this section over here today, and I promise you I'm not going to mention tithes, and I'm not going to mention offerings, and I'm not going to mention giving, so you can all sit easy.
Okay.
Because the minute you saw the word money on the screen, everyone went, right, well no, let's relax. Okay, so who is this message for? Well, this is the problem with money, and this is for our young people, really, to start with, which is that there are two routes through life. The broad road, which is what all your friends are doing, which is what all the advertising you see is telling you is the right way to go, which is what the bank is trying to get you to do, and so on and so on, which is probably what your finance lessons in schools are trying to get you to do. And then there's God's way, which is often, seemingly in the short term, less rewarding, but in the longer term, it leads to a better outcome. So that's for our young people, because if we don't make them aware of the message, all they ever hear is what the rest of the world is saying. Unless you haven't noticed, the rest of the world is in a bit of a financial pickle. So we don't want to go there. But for the older one among us, let's think about it this way. Have you ever taken a car for an MOT?
Yeah.
I drove it there can't be anything wrong with it. A bit like saying, well, look, I've got to this age and I haven't been declared bankrupt yet, so I must be doing okay. But it's always possible that when we actually look at the car, we might pick up one or two advisories. So I hope this is a message for all of us. We're going to start by talking about guns. Anyone know anything about that? Spot anything about that?
That's an American
yes.
service revolver from the Civil War.
Yes, naval actually, but yeah, it's a Colt, Colt revolver. Yeah. Yeah, the really significant bit is there, and it's a bit difficult to see in this picture. It's what's called part of Colt's signature series. Okay. Now, the way it worked was quite simply this. In the early 18th, early to middle 1800s, Samuel Colt developed these superior guns. And the way that they were made was pretty typical of the way that most things were made at the time. Six guys show up to work in the morning, Monday morning, and by Friday afternoon, each of them has made a gun. They are, you've produced six guns. And each person signs, autographs the gun they've made. Okay? Now, the problem was there was a huge amount of demand for this product, and Colt couldn't keep up. So he started thinking, well, what can I do? The obvious answer would be, if six guys make six guns, get 10 guys, get 20 guys, get a bigger workshop, employ all these different people. But Colt had been reading this book, published in 1776, very well worth a read. It's currently free on a certain well-known online bookseller, if you're interested. Adam Smith was a Scottish clergyman, and he was puzzled by why it was that when he travelled around the world, he would visit nations which had a good workforce, a highly skilled workforce, and plenty of natural resources, and yet some of them lived in absolute poverty, while others built tremendous wealth. And he thought, what's the difference? You know, it's nothing obvious, but what's the difference? And the answer he arrived at was specialisation. Now, let me explain what that means. Imagine a village full of subsistence farmers. They plant their crops, they tend their crops, they harvest their crops. They spend an hour every day with a little hand mill grinding flour, and you know that they provide for their families. And if their implements break, they light a fire in the back garden and they bang a couple of rocks together and shape the metal, and there you go. And they will never build wealth. They will never be anything other than subsistence farmers. Now, just across the border is another village of subsistence farmers. But these guys have noticed that Josh over there has a real passion for grinding wheat into flour, so much so that he's built a bigger millstone to do it with. And so they start taking their stuff to Josh to grind. And after a while, because he's so busy, he thinks he might make use of that river that runs through his property, and he builds a water wheel and attaches that to the grindstone. Now, of course, every time we take our flour to him to have, or wheat to him to have it ground, we have to pay him a bit. But what used to take us an hour a day, all year long, 365 hours, now takes 3 hours. What are we going to do with the other 362 hours? Well, I might improve my fields, or build better fences, or dig irrigation ditches, or, you know, whatever else. Okay? And exactly the same thing happened with the ironwork, that they, you know, they looked around and realised that on the other end of the village was Peter, who was passionate about ironwork, and he was really, really good, so people started taking their tools to him. And because it was worth his while, he didn't just rely on an open fire in the back garden, he built himself a forge, and he built real skills into everyone's taking the work to him. And the implements are now better, and they're repaired quicker, and to a higher standard, and this village will build wealth. So having read what Adam Smith wrote, Samuel Colt thought, well, I'll give that a go then. So Monday morning when he showed up to work, he called his workforce together, and he said, listen guys, we're going to do this differently. I happened to notice that you were really good at drilling barrels, so you're going to do that all day, every day, and you're going to get really good at it, and you're going to adapt your machine so that you can do it even quicker, and you're really good at, I don't know, filing trigger mechanisms, so that's what you're going to do. And then the first week they produced twice as many guns. Now why on earth am I telling you the story? Very simple, think about the money. When we find that there is more demand for our money than we have, our immediate answer is, well, I have to get more. I have to take on some overtime. I have to take that promotion I don't really want because I need more money, right? But maybe what we need to do is think about what we already have and learn to use it differently, just the way that Samuel Colt did, and double production. Of course, he went on to become the major supplier to the American military, and as I mentioned, that gun I showed you earlier was a naval revolver made by Mr. Colt.
Okay.
So thinking differently about the way we handle money. And so I've come up with five financial commandments. We're going to look at three this week, if time allows, and two next week to wrap the thing up. Okay. Number one, learn to live on a budget. Oh, really? That's in the Bible? Oh, yes. Right. So here we are, Luke 14. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Why don't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation stone and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. You will sit down and you will count the cost. Now, we'd all do that if we wanted an extension bill, wouldn't we? We'd work out the cost of everything. How many of us do it before starting to build the month? Right? So we fire off into the month thinking, I'm sure it'll work out somehow, but we would never do it if we were building an extension. We'd want to know how much this costs, all the way down to the light bulbs and the wallpaper, the floor, and everything needs to be worked out before we start. Well, that carries on in Proverbs 21, verse 5. The plans of the diligent lead to profit. As surely as haste leads to poverty. But what? The plans. Plan it out. It doesn't happen by chance. Make sure it happens on purpose. Here's another one. Proverbs 27. Be sure you know the condition of your flocks. Give careful attention to your herds. Well, I don't have flocks. What I have is an income and a bank balance. Be sure you know the condition of them. Work it all out. Where's it all going to go? Give every pound a name. Is it going here? Is it going here? Is it going here? All right, next one. Put your outdoor work in order and get your fields ready, and after that, build your house. In other words, there's a priority. There are some things you have to pay. There are some things you might need to pay. And there are some things that are optional. So you schedule your budget appropriately. Now, budgeting isn't... okay. It's not much of... You know, it's not a thing you look forward to doing, is it? So I'm going to give you three reasons why it's a powerful thing to help us with our money. First of all, it will save us money. You see, the problem is not really the amount of money we have. It's the fact that it tends to slip through our hands, rather like trying to walk along the beach with a handful of dry sand. Get to the end of the month and think, where did it all go? You start off thousands of pounds at the start of the month, and now I've got too much month left at the end of the money. How did that happen? Well, making a budget is simply like wetting the sand. It allows us to keep hold of it a bit more sensibly. In October last year, there was an article in The Guardian about a young woman who's a journalist in London who was earning really good money but felt she could never quite get ahead. She just ran out of money at the end of the month, every month. And her big complaint was, oh, I'll never get on the housing ladder, you know, as these millennials are wont to whine about. Okay, so she bought in the services of a financial advisor. Sat down with her, did an audit of everything she spent money on, and then helped her write a budget. First month, she stuck to the budget. She saved £300. What did she change? Well, nothing major. It was the little tiny, tiny things. It's what we call marginal gains. It's a little bit here, a little bit there. So, for example, she suddenly woke up to the fact that when she was going from here to three blocks down the road, without thinking, she was going down into the underground, swiping her Oyster card, getting on the tube, going one stop down and coming back up again. And frankly, by the time you'd waited for the tube train to arrive and milled through the crush of people, you could walk it in the same time. There you are, just saved £2.20. Now do that a few times and it starts to add up. One of the other big things she spent money on was coffee. Every morning of the week, she was going to a particular coffee shop, which will remain nameless. And the financial advisor asked her and said, is that really such a treat for you that you need to do it every day? And she said, well, actually, no, it is no longer a treat because I do it every day. And he said, well, why don't you do it just twice a week and then it's something to look forward to? And in the meantime, buy yourself a travel mug. And so the result was, at the end of the month, she'd saved £300. Wow, who knew? Second reason is because it gives us the freedom to spend without feeling guilty. Now, that sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? But let me ask you a question. Am I the only person who's ever spent money on something and afterwards thought, oh, I shouldn't have done that because I needed that money for? I'm not the only one, am I?
No.
No, good, okay, right. But if I have allocated money, this is money for this, and this is money for this, and this is money for this, why do I need to feel guilty because I spent the money that was for this on this? Because that's what the money's for. So it sets us free to spend what we have on what we want. But number three, I know this won't apply to all of our young people, it avoids arguments and ultimately divorce. Do you know the number one reason for marital arguments and disharmony is? Do you know one of the top five reasons for marriages to end in divorce is? Irreconcilable differences about money. Okay. Now, I'm going to say that I am blessed that in 21 years of marriage, we've never argued about money. And it wasn't because we had much. You know, we used to look at the poor people and think, hey, if we stick at it, one day we'll be like them. But anyway, in this book by Nikki and Scylla Lee, they're part of the Holy Trinity Brompton, you know, the Alpha Course, that sort of thing. Yes. They run marriage courses for Christians because they realised that Christian marriages fall apart just as often as non-Christian marriages. They dedicate an entire chapter to the subject of writing a budget. Why? Because think about it. She comes home and she's just blown a load of money on football tickets. And the argument kicks off because, well, I needed that money for, but weren't you thinking about, hang on, that money was in the budget for me to do that. Where's the argument? He comes home, he spent a load of money on makeup. And she says, what were you thinking? You knew we had to make this financial commitment this month. Hang on, that money was in the budget for makeup. Where's the argument? Right? There is no argument if you sit down and you work out a budget and you stick to it. Now, if a couple, A, cannot work out a budget together maturely like adults, and B, lack the integrity to stick to it afterwards, all right, you've got issues to maybe resolve. But you can see how this could save a marriage. Yes?
Okay. Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to the second. Oh, sorry, move on to the how-to. Right. Spreadsheet, bit of paper. This is a really interesting one, this. I'm not necessarily recommending this, nor am I receiving commission, but there are some incredibly clever apps on your phone. You're aware that you can pay with your mobile phone, right? In a lot of shops. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have these apps, when you pay at the till, it interrogates the till, and it will break down for you how much of that shop was groceries, dairy, vegetables, household items, entertainment. And so you can track your budget without needing to lift a finger. Isn't that amazing? All right, there are catches which you need to be careful of. But the way you do it is, well, you know, it's up to you, it's whatever you're comfortable with. But, okay, let's think about some more how-to. Number one rule, use cash. Number one rule, use cash. Cut up the credit card, let me explain why. If I asked you what was the single most aggressively marketed product in the history of products which has had more money spent on advertising than any other product ever, and I'll give you a clue, it's not double glazing, what would you think it would be? Credit cards. Visa alone made $10.4 billion profit last year. Out of people who think, it's all right, I pay off the balance at the end of the month. See, there are two problems with credit cards. One you might be aware of, one you're probably not. The first is, if you have the facility to spend money you don't have, sooner or later you will. It's just human nature. Sooner or later, some emergency will come along, and we will spend money we don't have. And then we get to pay it back with 49.9% interest on it. Mm-hmm. That's how they make some of that $10.4 billion profit. But the other one is more subtle. Studies have been done which prove that if you take a couple who earn X and do their shopping and so on and they use cash to pay, and you compare them to a person who earns X and uses a credit card, the person shopping with the credit card consistently spends 12 to 18% more over the space of a year than the person who pays with cash. Now just put that in context for a second. If you got to work on Monday morning and your boss says, hey, I'm really pleased with what you've been doing last week, I'm going to give you an 18% pay rise, how excited would we be? Right? You can take a pair of scissors when you get home and you can give yourself an 18% pay rise with one single movement. But how many of us will do it? And of course, the way that the credit card company earns out of this is simple. Every single transaction paid for with a credit card, they get a small percentage of. So if you're spending 18% more, well, they're making 18% more. So they win. And that's why they market credit cards so aggressively, because they know they will make money out of us. Well, not out of me, because I haven't got one, but, you know, out of us collectively. Pay with cash. Use an envelope system, put cash in an envelope. Put this for this, for this, for this. Put cash in different pockets of your wallet for different things. Whatever it is, use cash. It's a great way to actually save and stick to a budget. Of course, what's fascinating about this is, I know my parents' generation, when they came to Britain, they didn't have much money. They didn't have a choice. I remember they had money boxes. And when you got to the start of the month and you got paid, you'd pay your rent, whatever else, and you'd go to the bank and you'd take the money out and you'd divide it up into those compartments. And when the money in that compartment was gone, it was gone. That was it. So you learned how to live sensibly on a budget. All right, so number one, live on a budget. Number two, save for rainy days. Okay. There's a passage over here in Proverbs 21:20 which says, wise people store up the best food and olive oil, but fools eat up everything they have. According to God's definition, more than 80% of households in the United Kingdom are populated with fools. Because more than 80% of households in the United Kingdom live paycheck to paycheck with nothing left over at the end of the month. But according to the wisdom of the Bible, it says we should store up the future. So, what does this mean? Well, it means saving up for a rainy day, because you may have noticed that things have a habit of going wrong. The idea is that we put aside and we never touch between £500 and £1,000. So a young person living at home, their only major expense might be running a car, put £500 in the bank and keep it there and never touch it except for when you need it. For someone who's maybe married, got a house, whatever, put away up to £1,000. How? Sell stuff. eBay always get on the case just after Christmas, don't they? Did you know that there's more than £10,000 worth of unwanted items in the average house in the United States? £10,000 worth of unwanted items. Wow! Anyway, there you go. So that's one option, sell stuff. But probably the best way is to go back to commandment number one and just make sure that the budget contains some set aside every month. That might mean we have to reduce the amount of coffee we drink, or the number of times we eat cake, or whatever else, but set something aside every month. And I want to use a little bit of emotional learning to try and help illustrate how this works. Now, for the older ones of us now who drive cars that we just take for the MOT and it's a matter of, yeah, never mind, it'll come back with an MOT on it, we might have more or less forgotten what this feels like. But for the younger ones, do we remember that it's quite a stressful experience taking the car for its MOT? Yeah? Uh-huh. Right. Okay, and we're sitting there in the waiting room and we're thinking, but what if it fails? How am I going to get to work tomorrow morning? What if there's a huge bill and I can't afford to pay it? What if? And then you see the guy coming back from, and he's carrying the paperwork in his hand and you look at the thing. Is that walk the walk of someone who's just passed a car? Or is that the walk of someone who's about to bring you bad news? You know what I'm saying? And your heart starts pounding and you breathe in quicker and a bit sweat. Okay, how does that feel when you've got £500 in your pocket and it's not for anything else except paying the repair bill on the car? What is the stress? You see, there are two ways to be successful with money. Number one is to count it by saying, I've got more net worth than you've got. The other is to say, look at how much peace of mind the money I have has bought me. And it's not about numbers. It's about having in the right place to do the right thing with. Take the car for its MOT, £300 bill. There you go, cash. Can I have it tomorrow done? Takes all the stress out of life, doesn't it? Okay. So the second commandment is save up for rainy days. Now going back to that same verse again, number three is save for life events. And there's a fascinating part in this which needs a little bit of analysis really to make sense of. Why do you think the verse splits food and oil separately? It says in the house of the wise it's food and oil. Well, let me explain that. Do you remember the story of the widow in 2 Kings chapter 4 who went to Elisha and said, got a problem, I've got debt, and my kids are about to be repossessed. Do you remember the story? And Elisha said, well, what do you have in your house? And she says, I've got a jar of olive oil. Okay, pause there, grab your highlighter, underline that. What a bizarre thing to say. The house was completely bare, but she's got this jar of olive oil sitting on a table. Oh, hang on, no table, because the only thing in the house is the olive oil. Sounds odd, doesn't it? All right, we'll come back. So Elisha sends her off, he says, go raid all your neighbour's recycling bins, grab every single thing you can get, the 2 litre pop bottles, the beer cans, everything, bring it all back, close your doors and windows, and start pouring. And that's where the miracle comes in, right? So she pours from this bottle of oil, and she fills up all of these containers. And then Elisha says, go and sell it, pay off your debt, and live off the remainder. Highlight a moment again. How could he be so sure that she could sell this oil? Well, the answer is because back at that time, oil was absolutely vital in the Middle Eastern economy. For a start, most poor people did not eat much meat. That's why in the Bible, when it talks about killing an animal, it calls it a fellowship offering. And you took the animal all the way to the temple and had it killed and shared it with your neighbours, because you probably only did it once a year. And obviously you'd then eat when your neighbours killed an animal, but you might only eat meat two or three times in the entire year. So where did you get your fats and your proteins from? The answer is from olive oil. So olive oil was vital for bread making and for a healthy diet. Number two, of course, olive oil was the only way they had of providing light. Paraffin hadn't been invented yet, so they had to rely on olive oil. Now, if you were a wealthy person and you had both of those, you then used some of the leftover oil for cosmetics. Notice how many times the phrase in the Bible, he anoints my head with oil, or something similar comes up. Okay, so number three would be cosmetics. But number four is supple. It's a good way of storing value. You see, if you're wealthy enough to trade in coin or gold or precious stones or whatever, okay, that's where you store up value. But if you're an ordinary farmer with a couple of fields, and you, how long can you store your potatoes? A few months. How long can you store grain? A year or more in that dry climate. How do you store up value in case next year's harvest is no good? You get olive oil, you put it in a jar and you seal it with beeswax, and it'll keep for years. And so olive oil is a vital part of the Middle Eastern economy. So when Elisha said to the woman, "What do you have in your house?" she understood that what he was asking is, what do you have in your house which is valuable and marketable? So she probably had a bed and a chair and a cooking pot and a knife and a wooden spoon. Not interested in those things. What do you have which is marketable and valuable? And the answer is, well, I've got this jar of oil. And for the same reason, when God blessed her with all this oil, she then had a very marketable commodity which she could sell to the entire village. Just by the by, have you ever thought about the story of Jacob? He runs away from his brother. He's running for his life. How much luggage did he take with him? He managed to get a jar of olive oil in there, though. Yeah? Because the next morning, after he's had his dream, he sets up a standing stone and pours oil over it. And you think, what kind of person, running for their life, dashes back into the kitchen and grabs a bottle of frying oil before they leave? Well, when you understand how vital oil is to the Middle Eastern economy, it suddenly makes sense. And so the passage we looked at differentiates between people who store up food for the immediate future, for the next year until the harvest comes in, and those who store up oil to save for the long term. I call this the Scandinavian solution. You see, in Scandinavia they have this saying, which is, there's no such thing as bad weather, just the wrong clothing. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, there's really no such thing as a financial disaster, just something you didn't save up for. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Car breaks down, it's alright, I've saved up for it. Washing machine blows up, it's alright, I've saved up for it. You know, whatever else it is, there's no such thing as a financial calamity so long as we've saved up for it. Okay? Now, the advice that we are given by financial experts starts with this. We should save between 3 and 6 months' wages. Why? Because if you rock up at work on Monday morning and the gates padlock shut and there's a notice saying, sorry, the company went belly up over the weekend, good luck, it can take 3 to 6 months to get another job quite easily, especially in this day and age when nobody seems to be hiring. Then we could save for retirement, because it's not like we can pretend it's never going to happen. We should be looking forward to it. We might save up for a once-in-a-lifetime trip. Well, here's another one to think about for our young people. You know, when that little tiny baby is born, and you look at the baby, and you think to yourself, that's all right, this kid will never grow up, they'll never reach 18 years of age, they'll never want to get married, they'll never want to go to university, they'll never want some help buying their first house. Is that what we think? Or do we look at the little baby and think, you know what, one day this kid's going to need to get married. Maybe I'd better start putting some money aside now. A couple of pounds a month, a few pounds a month, good interest rate, because it's a long-term investment, 18 years down the line, can you give me some hand to buy my first house? How am I going to get a deposit together? I don't know. How about you use these savings that I've put aside for you? Okay. It's about storing up for the long term. How to? Well, here's another bit of advice from the Bible. Dishonest money dwindles away, but whoever gathers money little by little makes it grow. It's not about these big things we can do. Wow, if I win the lottery. No, it's not about that. It's about the £10 a month thing. It's about the £20 a month thing. It's about putting money aside little by little. This is what God says. Save bit by bit from the start so that we have those stores of food and oil, long-term value when we need it. And as a reference back to commandment number one, make saving a part of living on a budget. So, there's our first three commandments, and we'll look at the next two next week. But I wanted to just wrap this up today by bringing this back to a story. A number of years ago, I was talking to a Christian friend, and he was telling me about how it was that he was going to sell their house, and they were going to rearrange their finances in a particular way. And as I listened to him, I thought, no, you're crazy. And the reason I thought that way is because I'm a long-term thinker, okay? I could see how what he wanted to do made sense in the 1 year, 2 year span, but I thought, where's he going to be in 10 years' time? So I asked the question. I said, well, hang on a second. Have you thought about where you'll be in 10 years' time? You know what his answer was? Oh, we're just going to trust God. Okay. So he carried on, and I thought, no, and I can't just leave it like that. Because, I mean, how do you respond to that? Oh, we're just going to trust God. Well, what are you going to say as another Christian? Oh, I don't think you should be trusting God so much. You can't. So I had one more go, and I said, well, have you thought about what's going to happen when you get to retirement? Oh, we're hoping Jesus will come before that. And I thought, well, yeah, so am I. But, now at the time, I have to admit, I was stumped, and I didn't know what to say. But having given it some more thought, I've come up with a slightly different answer. You see, if I trust somebody, I'll listen to what they have to say to me, won't I? I'll take their advice. And so you see, the question is not between doing things our way or doing things some other way. It's between some sort of spurious claim that we trust God and really trusting God by reading what he says about money in the Bible and doing it, putting it into practice. And that's the question we have. Do we, like that picture of the broad road and the narrow road, do we listen to what the bank says? Because at the end of the day, they only exist to make money. Do we listen to what the credit card advert says? Do we listen to all our broke friends at school? Do we listen to our economics teacher at school who's driving a 20-year-old Volvo? Or do we listen to what God has to say, because God invented money? And he sort of knows how it works. That's the question we have to face. Thank you very much.